Hello, Marco Werman here with a quick word. January is just around the corner, which means time is running out to donate to our fundraiser before December 31st. If you've already donated, thank you. You are making it possible for us to bring the world to you every day, for us to cover the people at the center of what we think are the most important stories, and for us to follow the ripple effects of these stories and understand how one global event leads to another. If you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation won't just support our newsroom, it's also a vote of confidence for this kind of coverage. And you're helping to pay it forward for other listeners just like you who may not be in a position to give right now. Please donate today, support our nonprofit newsroom, and help fund all the stories we want to bring you in 2023. Visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks, and now the show. Trench warfare in Ukraine. A reporter embeds with troops facing Russian fire on the front lines. He says it's still less agonizing for journalists than for the fighters.
We don't really have to do anything other than turn our recorders on and grin and bear it.
Here in the U.S., Ukrainian Americans want to do their part.
You know, I knew I had to do something to showcase our culture, preserve our culture, and also help Ukraine by raising money.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the Supreme Court keeps Title 42 in place for the time being. Expulsion of asylum seekers under the Trump-era rule will continue at least for a few more months. And Brazil, it has one of the highest murder rates in the world. Sometimes it's hard to see who's taking the lead in law enforcement.
Currently in Brazil, there are more private security guards than police.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. We begin with immigration news. The Supreme Court has ruled that the Trump-era migrant expulsion policy known as Title 42 will remain active for the time being. That decision was announced on Tuesday. It's not the end of the story by any means. The court said it will hear arguments on Title 42 in February. So the legal battle over this single border policy drags on, and for many migrants at the southern border, the waiting continues. The World's Tibisa Isaiah reports that U.S. asylum policy has changed a lot.
The origin of Title 42 goes back to the 1940s. It's a paragraph in the U.S. code that allows U.S. authorities to deny entry into the U.S. to prevent spread of disease. When the COVID-19 virus was declared a pandemic in March of 2020, President Donald Trump invoked this order.
Our nation's top healthcare officials are extremely concerned about the grave public health consequences of mass uncontrolled cross-border movement.
Title 42 is a public health order and not an immigration order. But even when health authorities recognized that there was no longer a justification for it, the policy remained in place. Now it's been almost 3 years. And it has blocked millions of people from seeking asylum in the U.S., says Taylor Levy, an immigration attorney who helps migrants on the border.
Prior to Title 42, people had the right to seek asylum at the bridges. They could go to the bridge, they could ask for protection and be processed and be able to fight their cases and prove to a judge why they were coming here for truly exigent circumstances, fleeing extreme violence and persecution.
But since Title 42 was enacted, immigration authorities have used it to expel more than 2 million border crossers without even hearing their cases. Title 42 is supposed to apply to all nationalities, but Levy says, in practice, that's not the case. Most of the people who are turned back are from Mexico and Central America.
If you're Cuban or you're Nicaraguan, you will be able to most likely enter the United States and fight your case just like the normal system, because Mexico will not accept back those nationalities. And there are also no flight deportations to those countries because we don't have the same diplomatic relations with them.
She says Title 42 creates a system that excludes asylum seekers based on nationality and not according to their needs for protection. Last month, less than 1% of Cubans and Nicaraguans were turned back on their Title 42, compared to 60% of Mexicans. For those expelled, the situation they can expect on the Mexican side of the border is dramatic, says Adam Isaacson. He's an expert on security with the Washington Office on Latin America and was on the U.S.-Mexico border last week.
If you are expelled into Mexico, you're all of a sudden in a Mexican border city where you have no contacts, you don't have arrangements to have a roof over your head, you're homeless.
He says migrant shelters are scrambling to keep up with the need for beds. Many of the migrants sleep in tent camps in freezing temperatures. Daniel Berlin is the country's director of the International Rescue Committee. He says migrants stranded in the north of Mexico are very vulnerable to Mexican organized crime.
It's extremely common that the people who are returned from the U.S. are exposed to violent attacks, to robbery, to even sexual assault and murder.
Berlin says many of them decide to seek asylum in Mexico,
which places a significant burden on the Mexican system. Mexico just does not have the capacity to receive all of the people who are seeking asylum.
Those who are arguing in favor of Title 42 say the U.S. doesn't have that capacity either. But for the most part, these migrants plan to come back to the U.S. any way they can. This year, over 2 million people attempted to cross the border. That's higher than any other year in the recent history of the U.S. Many of them have been gathering with the expectation that Title 42 will be ending. But they'll have to wait at least for a few more months for the next move from the Supreme Court. For The World, I'm Divisa Isea.
The war in Ukraine is in many ways on vivid display for all to see. Social media and drone footage have heightened the ability to know what's going on. If we're talking the front lines, though, that's more opaque. The Ukrainian military has not allowed many reporters to be at the front. That's why Luke Mogelson, a writer for The New Yorker, made an effort to do so. He was granted permission to report on Ukraine's so-called International Legion, fighters from around the world who wanted to help defending Ukraine. Luke was with them in the muddy trenches in the eastern part of the country. Luke Mogelson, this story begins in Kyiv, where you met an American soldier codenamed Doc. How did he set your expectations for what you were getting yourself into?
Well, Doc had been fighting in Ukraine since the very beginning of the war in March, and he and his team had been conducting reconnaissance around the front lines in the no man's land between the Ukrainian and Russian trenches. Their comrades had been killed, others injured. They, above all, had experienced a lot of very heavy artillery and shelling. So that's kind of what he advised myself and the photographer to expect.
Tell us more about this International Legion that you were embedded with. Who are they and what is their job within Ukraine's military?
Well, at the very beginning of the war, President Zelensky put out a call for foreign volunteers with combat experience to come to the country and support the Ukrainian armed forces. Thousands responded from as many as 52 different countries. But after the first couple of months, there was an extremely high attrition rate within what came to be known as the International Legion, because a lot of the foreigners, even if they had participated in the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, were not prepared for the reality of artillery and trench warfare.
I mean, your first mission with this Legion, what struck you about it?
Well, it was interesting because they operate mostly at night. This particular team has the benefit of night vision goggles, which the Russians generally lack. So that gives them an advantage and an ability to maneuver at night in the areas between the two opposing front lines. But they're still extremely exposed because the skies are constantly patrolled by drones. And many of those drones, especially the Russian Orlans, are equipped with thermal camera capacity so they can detect the heat signatures of bodies and vehicles. just getting from point A to point B anywhere on the battlefield is an extremely risky undertaking.
I mean, Luke, you're kind of getting to some of my next question. When we think trench warfare, we think World War One, a really brutal form of battle. Talk about what trench warfare is like in eastern Ukraine in 2022.
Well, it's a kind of interesting and almost paradoxical hybrid of anachronistic, old school trench warfare of the type that one might imagine having seen World War II and World War I movies, where you have infantrymen literally just holding the line in hand-dug foxholes and trenches that, especially in the fall and the winter, are quite miserable, muddy and filled with water, with just some felled timber and trees for overhead cover. And they're basically just tasked with weathering a relentless onslaught of tank fire and artillery and rockets.
I'm speaking with New Yorker contributing writer Luke Mogelson about his latest article, Trapped in the Trenches. Luke, is the importance of trench warfare and what it means for Ukraine's fortunes so far in the fight against Russia, has that been lost in the broader story of the war?
Only in the spring, once the war really shifted to the rural terrain of the Donbas, did this style of fighting in trenches and this kind of attritional combat really become the dominant form of fighting in Ukraine. And it might shift again.
During your reporting, Luke, you experienced a near miss, a serious near miss. What happened and what did you come away thinking about it?
Well, this was during a mission to probe a tree line that accessed a village called Pavlivka that the Russians had pushed on a couple days earlier and largely captured. So I was with an American who stayed a little bit back from the rest of the team to conduct drone surveillance of the tree line while his comrades were moving through it. Mm. And we were stationed in a small house. And while we were there, the whole neighborhood that we were in was targeted for about an hour by Russian artillery and rockets and tank fire. We were kind of crammed into a small root cellar while pieces of the house were collapsing above us.
What went through your head?
Well, I was mostly impressed by the professionalism of the volunteers and the Ukrainian soldiers that I was with, because it's pretty easy for a journalist to just sit through something like that and survive it. We don't really have to do anything other than turn our recorders on and grin and bear it. But the soldiers, on the other hand, have to make decisions, function efficiently, and actually continue with their work under that same intense pressure.
Luke Mogelson is a contributing writer at the New Yorker magazine, speaking with us about his time embedded with Ukraine's International Legion on the front lines. You can read more in his gripping article, Trapped in the Trenches. Luke, thanks very much.
Thank you.
4 years to the day, that's how long Paul Whelan has been in Russian detention. A statement from the U.S. State Department today says that Whelan has been, quote, wrongfully detained away from his family, suffering through an unfathomable ordeal. A Russian court sentenced Whelan, an American citizen, to 16 years in prison on espionage charges. Both the U.S. government and the Whelan family say those charges are baseless, and they accuse the Kremlin of holding Whelan as a political prisoner. Earlier this month, WNBA star Brittany Griner was released from Russian prison. Here's President Biden speaking on that same day.
We never forgot about Brittany. We've not forgotten about Paul Whelan, who's been unjustly detained in Russia for years.
The Biden White House had hoped to include Whelan in the prisoner swap that ended up freeing Griner. That did not happen.
While we have not yet succeeded in securing Paul's release, we are not giving up. We will never give up. We remain in close touch with Paul's family, the Whelan family, and my thoughts and prayers are with them today. They have to have such mixed emotions today. And we'll keep negotiating in good faith for Paul's release. I guarantee that. I say that to the family. I guarantee you.
Today, the Biden administration repeated that promise in a statement that says, in part, efforts to secure Paul's release will not cease until he is back home with his family where he belongs. Brittany Griner is encouraging her fans to send letters to Paul Whelan and to continue to, quote, advocate for other Americans to be rescued and returned to their families. Just ahead, we go to Brazil to look at the role of private police in the country's gun violence. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Brazil has a reputation for violence. Tens of thousands of lives are lost each year because of the illegal trade in drugs and guns. Brazilian cities have some of the highest numbers of robberies and carjackings in the world. In this environment, some people and businesses have long relied on private security guards for protection. Today, they actually outnumber the official police. But who exactly are these guns for hire? That is the question our partners at the Conversation Weekly podcast asked. I'm joined by co-host Gemma Ware, who is in London. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you, Gemma.
Thanks for having me.
So set this story up. What's going on?
Sure. So at the Conversation Weekly, we talked to some academics doing some pretty novel and interesting stuff. And one of those people is Erica Robb Larkins. She's a professor at San Diego State University, and she studies the anthropology of violence. Her focus is on Brazil, where she's spent a lot of time since she was young. While working on her PhD, she lived in a favela in Rio, one of the city's poorest neighborhoods. And she saw a lot of violence there, gun battles between drug traffickers and police. So she began interviewing police officers, which is where it got really interesting. And from here, I'll let Erica tell her story.
Lots of these high-ranking police officers would mention that they owned private security companies. Currently in Brazil, there are more private security guards than police, but we know very little about the field. They're not very well regulated, but they're enmeshed with and intertwined with police and military in very significant ways. And so I wanted to kind of untangle that puzzle. And so I started to follow private security guards through their training and then into the workplace. So I spent a lot of time in these private security training facilities. At the time that I was doing my research, the armed theft of cargo was incredibly high in Rio. And so a lot of the courses that I accompanied were populated by people that were going to go into these really high combat situations. They were going to be carrying a gun every day and possibly taking fire almost every day in their workplaces. Despite that, however, the training is incredibly rudimentary. I mean, shockingly rudimentary.
The weapons the guards were being trained with were often old, broken, and prone to jamming. Although ironically, the service weapons they're given when they start work as security guards often have similar problems.
The instructor would come and like put a bunch of guns on like a plastic table, and we would sit there and load and unload the guns as a way to sort of create a muscle memory and have an interaction with them that would hopefully, you know, provide some kind of a familiarity that could be carried over into the workplace.
So you're good at this now too?
I mean, I would not say that I'm good. I would say that by the end of my fieldwork, my hands wouldn't shake. And at the beginning of my fieldwork, I had never held a gun before, and I was really nervous.
As she was sitting there, talking to the trainee security guards, loading and unloading their glitchy guns, Erica began to find out more about who they were. For the most part, these men, and they were all men, were black and came from poor backgrounds.
But as you move through the hierarchy, the skin tones change, right? So this tells you a lot about structural racism in Brazil as well, because the owners of the companies are not black, you know, and even the managers are usually more light-skinned than the lowest level guards.
She found that the lower level guards broadly fitted into two main groups.
One is people that are interested in this career path, not because they're longing to work in these militarized settings, but because it offers them a formal work contract, an insurance plan, and they earn a little more money than they would in another industry.
This group of guards were fairly cynical about their work and would sometimes refer to themselves as cannon fodder.
The other group has maybe a military background. Perhaps they enjoyed their military service. They like working with guns. They have some technical background or training. I'm thinking of one person in particular that I interviewed at one of the training schools. And I said, well, why are you in this profession? And he was like, well, the war is already here. I'm just going to it instead of it coming to me. And I was sort of like, well, what war? you know, and he was like, well, the war between, you know, good upstanding citizens and criminals who try, you know, to rob people and, you know, sow discord in general.
This second group were intrigued by American gun culture, and this is something that Erica also saw amongst drug traffickers who lived in the Rio favela.
There were drug traffickers whose nicknames were Rambo. People made constant reference to U.S. films, especially about the U.S. military. Traffickers that I interviewed talked about how beautiful the U.S. Army fatigues were and how amazing the U.S. Army's equipment was.
The security guards were also really interested in Americans' access to guns.
They were often, you know, asked me lots of questions. I heard you can just go into the Walmart and buy a gun in the U.S. Is that true? But overall, they were intrigued by the access to guns and the easy access, and often would say, like, well, we wouldn't have the problems that we have in Brazil if everyone could just have a gun, or if they had a gun.
That was San Diego State University professor Erica Robb Larkin speaking with Gemma Ware, the host of the Conversation Weekly podcast. Gemma, private gun ownership really spiked under President Jair Bolsonaro as part of his Get Tough on Crime initiative, though it's not anywhere near the rates we have in the U.S. Now, incoming President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva wants to make it much harder for private citizens to buy guns. But will he be able to roll it back?
Well, yeah, he definitely wants to. And a school shooting in late November in the state of Espírito Santo kept the issue in the front of people's minds. But some of Bolsonaro's relaxation of the gun laws was done through a type of presidential executive order, which means that Lula can reverse them once he takes office in January. Passing stricter gun laws, though, through Brazil's Congress might be tricky because although Lula won the presidential election, his Workers' Party doesn't have a majority in either the Senate or the lower house of Congress. Still, I've been talking to another academic called Juliano Cortinas at the University of Brasilia, and he was telling me that Lula's main priority will be the reconstruction of the economy. That may mean that to win votes in Congress, he's going to have to do some tough negotiations with conservative pro-gun congressmen. And keeping them on side may mean that Lula needs to make some careful considerations about which executive orders to reverse and when.
What do these debates tell you, Gemma, about Brazil that you might not have known before?
I think it would be how guns were such a useful political tool for Bolsonaro. He used access to guns in his political rhetoric to stir up a really polarizing debate about who in Brazil is a so-called good citizen and who is a bad citizen. And for those Brazilians who believe that and believe that they are the good guys and that they need guns to protect themselves against their enemies, this mentality that there's a kind of war going on is just not going to disappear. So even if Lula does manage to tighten gun laws again, this issue will continue to divide Brazilians.
Gemma Ware are the co-hosts of the podcast, The Conversation Weekly. Each Thursday, they speak with academics and highlight their research. Gemma, thanks very much for sharing this story with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Some Mexican drug cartels are going back to an old technique to win hearts and minds, offering holiday gifts. This week online, we've seen videos of trucks driving through a low-income neighborhood in Guadalajara. The convoy had inflatable Santa decorations and Christmas lights, and the people in the convoy were handing out presents, mostly toys, while they played music praising the Jalisco drug cartel. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was asked about the videos yesterday. He said this was all part of a strategy by criminal gangs to attract popular support, and he appealed to the public not to take holiday handouts from drug gangs. We'll be right back with more this hour. You're listening to The World. Soviet cosmonauts during the Cold War communicated with mission control back in the USSR. For more casual conversation, they connected with a ham radio operator in Australia.
It's beautiful here, but very, very cold.
You need a bottle of hot milk.
Chatting with Soviets in space, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Today, Kosovo closed its biggest border crossing with Serbia. It's not good news. It comes after weeks of rising tensions between the two neighbors. There is a sizable ethnic Serbian minority in northern Kosovo. Members of that community have put up barricades in protest. Serbia's armed forces are on high alert, and members of Kosovo's police forces, along with international peacekeepers, have come under shooting attacks in recent weeks. The tensions are centered on the Kosovo city of Mitrovica. Joining us now is Tim Judah, who writes for The Economist. He recently returned from Kosovo and joins us now from London. Tim, break down for us what's happened on the border between Kosovo and Serbia.
Well, what's happened in the last 24 hours is that Serbs put up barricades on the other side, on the Serbian side of the border, at a place called Merdare. And therefore, that border has now been closed. That's quite a significant escalation in the crisis because it's the main road from Kosovo into Serbia. And it's also the main road that the diaspora use. Kosovo, Albanians especially, have a huge diaspora. It's the holidays. There's normally thousands of people coming and going at this season, and now they can't use that. So it's quite a significant escalation. On the other hand, what has also happened is that a policeman, a Kosovo Serb former policeman who had been arrested a couple of weeks ago, which was why the barricades went up in the first place, has been sent to house arrest today. And that's also significant because in the discussions about how to end this particular crisis, getting this man into house arrest, because he's quite sick apparently, was one of the conditions.
You were recently on assignment in the area around the Kosovo city at the heart of these tensions, Mitrovica. Tell us what you saw there.
Well, Mitrovica is a sort of rather down-at-heel former mining city, and it is divided in two. I mean, literally divided in two by a river, but it's divided in two ethnically in the sense that the south part of the city is mostly Albanians and the north is mostly Kosovo Serbs. You can cross at a bridge in the middle of the town. It's been closed to traffic since the end of the Kosovo War in 1999, but you can walk over that bridge. And it's like walking into a different country. It's like walking from Kosovo into Serbia. The whole place is festooned with Serbian flags. They use euros like in the rest of Kosovo, but they also use Serbian dinars. There's what they call parallel structures. So there are Serbian officials operating there in Serbian institutions, although in a kind of gray zone. And what I saw this time, which is different from previous times, was that stenciled on the walls, there are some type of Serbian crest. They say, Northern Brigade, don't worry, we are waiting. And the implication of this and the gossip is that this is some sort of Serbian militia in waiting. But no one really knows whether it exists or whether this is some sort of clever publicity to sort of imply that something exists. There's a kind of like menacing undertone. And unless some resolution is patched together very soon, it could be very explosive up there.
So Serbia's military forces on the border have been placed on the highest level of combat alert. Is there a real threat of Serbia sending troops into Kosovo?
No, that's just total rubbish. It's complete zero. Serbia cannot send troops into Kosovo because that would immediately trigger NATO into stopping them and kicking them out. I mean, that's the deal. Kosovo's security is provided by NATO. There are up to 4,000 troops in there. And who can call on reinforcements to come? So, no, this is totally and utterly a PR stunt for Serbia's domestic audience and possibly for an international audience. But it's total rubbish because Serbia's army is not about to roll into the north of Kosovo. What is a risk is that some sort of militias or little green men controlled by the Serbian authorities, they appear. That's a risk, but not the regular Serbian army with tanks, etc., rolling into Kosovo. Absolutely not.
So NATO is there to keep the peace. How are the US and other NATO members responding to the current tensions?
Well, I think they're being extremely active, but you know, they're not doing it in public. There is a US special envoy for Kosovo who is working very closely with his EU counterpart, Miroslav Lajčak, and they've been working for months trying to decrease tensions. This is like the seventh crisis, I think, since June that they've been trying to tamp down. And what they really want to do is they really want to get Serbia's leader and Kosovo's leader talking again to find a sort of long-term solution, a normalization of relations between Serbia and Kosovo. And there's an impression that not much is being done. I realize that from questions put to me by Kosovo Albanian journalist colleagues, but they're just wrong. It's like they're not talking about it. It's not in public. I think there is a lot of diplomacy going on behind the scenes.
Tim, you're reporting on this region, Kosovo and Serbia in particular. I mean, it goes back to the breakup of the former Yugoslavia more than two decades ago. In your experience, how serious are these current tensions?
These tensions are very serious because in the past, when you've had these tensions, the diplomats come in, barricades go down, people talk, life goes on until the next crisis. But this one just feels very different. It's because the Serbs have left various institutions, including the Kosovo police in the north. They've kind of left parliament. They've left kind of municipal assemblies. It's quite difficult to go back. And the fact is that, well, I mean, I went to one of the barricades, one of the big barricades in a place called Rudare, which is quite close to Mitrovica. There, you know, you have kind of trucks and other things kind of blocking the road, including a big petrol tanker. And a colleague I was with said, you know, a lot of people are not very happy about this petrol tanker because it's full. And so if something happens, if there's an incident, then this thing could explode. And if that explodes and people get killed, then, you know, all hell could break loose. And if somebody else tried to dismantle barricades, by which I'm talking about the EU police or primarily KFOR, which is the NATO force up there, you know, that's a risk that something could happen. Serbs could get killed or Albanians could get killed. And then you kind of have a sort of uncontrolled wave of violence, which has happened before. This happened in 2004. So it's not as though we haven't been there before.
We've been speaking with Tim Juda with The Economist. He's been covering the tensions in Kosovo and Serbia. He joined us from London. Thank you very much for your time, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
Yesterday, we brought you an update on the peace deal in the Tigray region of northern Ethiopia. Basic services are beginning to resume in the region that sits along the border of Ethiopia and Eritrea. Today, we've got a correction to that interview. Our guest stated that the Ethiopian National Defense Forces were withdrawing from Tigray as part of the peace deal. In fact, the agreement signed last month allows the ENDF to return to the regional capital of Mekele. As the war in Ukraine raged through the year, Ukrainian Americans, thousands of miles away, have anxiously watched the news. More than 1 million Ukrainian immigrants and the descendants of emigres from Ukraine live in the U.S. today. Reporter Ashley Westerman has this story of how the second largest Ukrainian American community, just outside Philadelphia, chose to focus on preserving their culture during this holiday season.
It's dress rehearsal night for the Voloshky School of Ukrainian Dance. Dozens of children and parents mill about the lobby of the Josephine Muller Auditorium in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. The Ukrainian Nutcracker is the brainchild of dance school director Larissa Spisik.
When the war broke out, I knew I had to do something to showcase our culture, preserve our culture, and also help Ukraine by raising money.
But the Nutcracker isn't Peter Tchaikovsky Russian?
Yeah, so he actually has Ukrainian ancestry. I believe it was his great-grandfather who was born in Ukraine. So Ukrainians feel very strongly that we do have some personal connection to him as well. And we wanted to kind of embrace that.
She says this year, because of Russia's invasion, the Nutcracker will have a very special impact. Spisik's family is from Lviv, Ukraine.
It's very challenging. Definitely feel helpless at times because we are over here and we can give support and prayers and good wishes, but physically, we're really not able to do much.
This sense of helplessness was echoed by Ulana Dubas.
Early on in February, we sort of glued to our phones and the computer, just seeing everything that was happening and sort of seeing it still continue is horrific.
But the community has been resilient and strong, she says.
We did a lot of drives of clothing and food early on, monetary donations. So like that really brought the community together in some ways. And that's still continuing now because it has to.
Dubas says this production, which her daughter is dancing in, showcases her community's strength. Backstage, dancers line up, ready to go on stage. They're in bright red Ukrainian coral necklaces, flower crowns, and vishivankas, Ukraine's brightly colored traditional outfits. But on opening night Friday, it wasn't just the switch to Ukrainian costumes that made it to the stage.
Please welcome the chair of the Ukrainian Nutcracker Committee, Katria Kovaya.
Вітаємо вас на прем'єрі нашої унікальної інтерпретації святкового.
Among other surprises, Ukrainian language, Ukrainian decorations, dolls, and food were all on stage in the play's iconic party scene in the opening act. Instead of the land of the sweets, it was the land of the Kalina, Ukraine's iconic red-berry bush. And of course, lots of Ukrainian folk dancing.
Thank you.
A handful of different Philadelphia organizations chipped in to help, including the Metropolitan Ballet Company, a testament, the production's lead say, to the overall support Ukrainian Americans feel they've received since Russia invaded Ukraine. After the show, Anne Dubas, clad in a Vyshyvanka, says she's cried a lot this year. She cries for her family and for her country. So Dubas really loved seeing their community come together during the holidays.
It keeps Ukraine alive. It keeps everyone asking questions. Who are Ukrainians? What do they stand for? And our children and our grandchildren are performing. It goes on. It's wonderful.
For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania.
The holidays reconnect us with friends and loved ones, which is why, if you're alone, the season can feel isolating. This next story is about one woman who kept some people company, people who are about as isolated as you can get, in outer space. Margaret Iaquinto was an American living in Australia, schoolteacher, ham radio operator, and Russian linguist. This was in the late 1980s in what were the waning days of the Cold War. From her kitchen table, Iaquinto was able to make contact with Soviet cosmonauts in space. Conversations like this went on for a few years.
I really liked the space chicken recipe. to cook a chicken recipe. Very nice. Over.
Margaret Iaquinto died in 2014, but her son Ben remembers the friendship between her and one cosmonaut in particular, Sergei Krikalev. Ben Iaquinto lives today in Hong Kong. He remembers well his mom's enthusiasm for ham radio and connecting with the cosmonauts on the Mir space station.
The idea was something that many amateur radio operators had. They knew that these guys were in space, and they knew that they had ham radios. So there was people all around the world who wanted to communicate with them and make contact. And my mom was one of the few people who was able to actually make contact and to break through. And she was absolutely delighted in doing that. And it's something that I remember to this day, the conversations that she had, the voices of these Russian guys.
It's beautiful here, but very, very cold.
You need a bottle of hot milk.
We could always hear their voices almost every day during, you know, maybe a 3 to 4 year period in the early 90s, early in the morning. Wow. And she invited some students as well from her high school that came to our house and also spoke with the cosmonauts. So it became a kind of like a community event, I guess you could say.
And yeah. Technically, do you recall if it was hard to do, make a terrestrial connection on ham radio to a space station?
I do remember there were challenges. Firstly, you had to know what frequency the cosmonauts were talking on. You also had to know the trajectory of the Mir space station and the times in which it was going to pass over Australia. And she had antennas that were set up. I can remember an antenna that was movable. You could move it up and you can move it left and right, and you could kind of track the space station as it moved over Australia. And so having the right equipment, knowing the frequency, knowing when they were going to appear overhead, things that were challenges that eventually she was able to overcome.
What do you remember about your mother's conversations with Krikalev, for example? Did she explain what, you know, she had been speaking with him about?
They would talk just about what they were doing that day, but they would also speak about technical things. She used to share the news with him because he wasn't able to access it being behind the Iron Curtain, I guess, in the USSR. So she would share just world news. And sometimes they would sing songs and just sort of joke around. So there was a lot of laughing as well.
Krikalev and your mother, Margaret, eventually met in person in 1994, but you also met him, right? Tell us about that. What did Krikalev say about being in space and speaking so regularly with this stranger who became a companion, really?
My memories are quite sort of vague because I was so young, but he was a really nice guy. And it was just, it was a, I just remember that time very fondly. It was very exciting and everyone was so enthusiastic and happy, and people were just, yeah, it was kind of like a party atmosphere.
Your mom was so passionate about ham radio, she ended up speaking to many Russian cosmonauts. Why do you think she was the one to be speaking basically every day with these cosmonauts in space? What does that tell us about what kind of person she was?
I remember speaking more broadly about the type of person she was. She was definitely someone that was known in the community. And when we moved to Melbourne, she was someone who got to know all of the neighbors. She was quite social in that way. And I also think being a woman was something that made her very different, because ham radio is such a male-dominated field, or at least it was back then. I'm not sure what it's like now. And so that definitely would have been something that was quite different for the cosmonauts to hear a woman's voice, and being able to converse in Russian was such an asset.
Еще раз, пожалуйста, и по-английски.
She was a teacher, and so she had that kind of teaching ethos where she wanted to learn and she also wanted to help.
Well, Ben Iaquinto, thank you very much for telling us about your mother and how she kept the cosmonauts from being bored up there on the Mir space station.
No worries.
Protesters in Iran continue to face a brutal crackdown as they struggle for women's rights. The government has sanctioned beatings, arrests, and executions. That's what we're looking at now, and a warning, our discussion is not suitable for all listeners. There is another tactic Iran's government is using to control women, rape. Firuzeh Mahmoudi joins us to talk about this. She's the president of United for Iran, a nonprofit advocating for civil and human rights there. Firuzeh joins us from the San Francisco Bay Area. How long have we known about rape being used as a tool of oppression in Iran, Firuzeh?
Rape has been used as a tool of oppression in Iran since the beginning of the Islamic Republic. In the very beginning years, they consolidated power. So one by one, they went after the other political groups. In one summer, they killed thousands of people, close to 10,000. And during that summer and during those years, they would rape women who they believed were virgins before executing them, because it's non-Islamic, they said, to execute women who are virgins. So we're dealing with this kind of behavior by the Islamic Republic.
Yeah, so how big has the rise in the number of cases of women raped in prison since the start of the protests for women's rights in Iran been? Are there accurate data?
I don't know if we have exact data, but we know that there are dozens of cases.
Why do you think this tactic, Firuzeh, is being used increasingly in Iran right now?
Whenever they feel insecure about their existence, and now is they feel most insecure that they ever have in the last 43 years, they will use any tactic they can to oppress people. This is what they have to come to in order to control their own population, their kids and their grandkids and their great-grandkids. These are all forms of oppression and misogyny, and rape is also falls in this category. It's a way to not only oppress people, but to degrade them, and to for the men and the women, and to make a clear indication to others that this will be your fate if you go in the street.
So you're saying there's a direct correlation between the sense of insecurity of the state and the draconian tools, including rape and execution, they'll resort to?
Absolutely. We see that. We see that they shut down the internet and start killing people in the ethnic minority regions during uprisings, and they increase violence every single time. They increase arrests. Absolutely.
Is that increasingly authoritarian hand having any effect, though?
No. I think killing and violence is a tool if people are scared. People, not that they're not scared. I like one definition of bravery, that you do something even though you are scared. That's really being brave. And the people in Iran are incredibly brave. It's unbelievable. It's unfathomable what they're doing. They know all of this, and they're still in the streets. They say the chances are, like, we have more bodies than you have bullets. Our anger is bigger than your power. They are saying that for every person you kill, there's another 1,000 of us behind them. And we see that. There's ebbs and flows, of course, to the days. But in Iran, 40th day is a very auspicious day after death. So people are showing up. People are showing up for each other in everywhere, every way and everywhere.
Firuzeh, I'm also wondering what happens to women in Iran after they experience rape in prison. How does society view them?
Generally speaking, people are very supportive. They understand what's going on. They stand up for each other. And there's a lot of respect for women and men. And they're revered, in fact. And they're seen for their bravery. And they're no longer blaming themselves. I mean, of course, there's still some of that happening, especially more rural areas or areas that are not the bigger cities. But people are understanding that sexual assault is a form of violation and that they're being violated and assaulted, and it's not, they haven't done anything, it's not on them. That there's a lot more clarity, so people are coming forward and speaking about it much more than they used to.
It really seems as if there is total impunity for how the Iranian government is treating those who oppose it right now. Foreign criticism is ignored, no foreign journalists to monitor and document what's happening, certainly not behind prison walls. What occurs to you when you think about what can be done to further protect women in Iran right now?
So we're seeing this global pattern that this is not okay, and there people are trying to do whatever they can, governments as well as journalists and prominent individuals doing whatever they can to stand up. There's a woman actress who's just got arrested for simply standing up in solidarity and taking her job off, and they took her in, and people, various actors and actresses and entities around the world are standing up in her solidarity. So people are doing that for their counterparts. We're seeing soccer players advocating for soccer players. So we're seeing that. We're seeing citizens standing up. We're seeing Iranian-American diaspora community and any hyphenated.
Firzeh Mahmoudi is the president of United for Iran, a nonprofit advocating for civil and human rights in Iran. She joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. We're very grateful for your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
The war in Ukraine has sent shockwaves through some unexpected parts of the global economy. Join us tomorrow on The World when we'll look at one example, fertilizer. Russia is the world's largest producer of chemical fertilizer, and while there are no sanctions against Russian agriculture, many shipping companies now refuse to transport it. We'll look at the ripple effects on farming and food that that's having around the globe tomorrow on The World. Once again, health experts are saying it's time to put that mask back on. The pandemic ain't over yet. And it's winter, which means fewer windows are open. The flu is also making a lot of people sick, so it's in the spirit of good health and recognizing the people who have to continue working when things are bad. Now we close today with this track from Belgian crooner Stromae. It's called Santé, or Health. Céline, Bater, toi tu te prends des vestes au vestiaire. Arlette, arrête. In the first verse, Stromae sings the praises of essential workers. Rosa, a house cleaner. Albert, a busboy. Céline, a Kochek girl. For once, Stromae sings in the chorus, I want to raise my glass to people we don't usually celebrate. Hear, hear. This number by Stromae is one of the end-of-the-year music picks chosen by our staff here at The World. A nod to producer Anna Kussmer, who's a big Stromae fan. You can find that full list of picks on Spotify. The playlist there is called A Musical Journey Around the Globe 2022. We've linked to it on our Twitter feed as well, where we are at The World. And that's going to do it for us this Wednesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and healthy. Thanks for being here. Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.